meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. I want to get right at this and start out with Clint Van Zandt. You know, Clint is a retired FBI agent, author, security expert, regular guest on the program here. We're going to talk about this tragedy in North Carolina and the nursing home, the shootings there, and a little bit later on the smiley face murders. There's always something to talk about when Clint's on. Hi, Clint. How are you?
Hey, Dana. Good to be with you.
Let's get into North Carolina. Boy, I'll tell you, every time you turn the news on, something crazy like this happens.
This was just a crazy, murderous weekend in America. We had this shooting in North Carolina where we had just so many senior citizens shot and killed. And then we had an individual in Santa Clara, California, kill four of his own children, critically wound his wife, and commit suicide. And then there were, you know, at least two other major shootings that have taken place in the states within the last couple of days. It's, you know, I did a couple of other radio shows today, and there's so many. I mean, you almost lose track of which one you're talking about. That's a sad thing in this country.
Yeah, something's going on. We can't forget about the four officers in Oakland that lost their lives.
Absolutely.
And then seeing, you know, I hate to segue from one to the other, but like you say, it's hard to tell what story we're talking about. But seeing the protests protests of support for the shooter, and you got to wonder what the hell's going on with the world, Clint.
Well, it is. And you know, in the case of the shooter, I was, years ago, I was in Rochester, New York as an FBI agent. And we had a, police officers were trying to arrest a guy who was high on PCP one time. And they had maced him and hit him with nightsticks. And he was still able to wrestle one officer's revolver from his holster and shoot five police officers with the sixth officer's gun. I mean, and people were saying, oh, you know, gee, the cops are really picking on that guy. No, they were fighting for their life is what they were doing.
You know, and I'm going to get into this a little later on with another guest on the program tonight, but I tell you, I am getting so sick of the negative reports about police officers. Yeah, Drew Peterson has been out of policing for a long time now, but they still call him Sergeant Drew Peterson. Mm-hmm. We hear about all the negativity. Yeah, it's out there. Yes, we accept that, but when's the last time you heard something good about what a cop did besides the fact the tragedies when they lose their lives?
Well, let's talk about this 4.5 year police veteran in North Carolina.
Yeah.
This small police department, you know, 1,800 people live in a community. He's the first responding officer when calls are coming in, you know, gun seen, shots fired. And you and I know that since Columbine High School, we've learned that in the active shooter program, we just don't have the time to wait for SWAT to come up and suit up and go in. The first, second, and third responding officers, you've got to go. You've got to penetrate. You've got to find the shooter. You've got to engage the shooter, and you've got to put him down. And that's the only way to stop this murder and mayhem. Well, this young cop in North Carolina, 25 years old, been on the job 4.5 years, first and sole responding officer, instead of saying, what am I going to do, scratch his head, look around for help, he did what he had to do, Dana. And as you know, he penetrated, he got in, he found the gunman who was armed with at least a 12-gauge shotgun firing what I believe to be double-aught buck, as well as at least one other weapon. This young officer engaged this guy in a shootout in the hall, made him shoot at the officer so he couldn't keep shooting senior citizens, and even though the officer took 3 rounds in the leg, he managed to plant a .40 caliber round in the chest of the shooter to finally put him down. Dana, you know, if this was combat, I would put that guy in for the Medal of Honor.
Absolutely, and at 20-some grand a year or whatever he's making, probably absolutely nothing, laying their lives on the line, you know, I'm kind of told myself not to get too worked up about this tonight, but it's hard not to. But when you see a story like this, Clint, when you see the North Carolinas, the Oaklands, all the other ones across North America, and you see the gun lobbyists come out, and some will say, well, if the orderly in the nursing home was armed, he would have been able to shoot this guy. And then you get the other side saying, well, all guns should be banned. But it's a much bigger story than that.
Yeah, and it is a bigger story. And that's it. We always, you know, in the States, people always look for an issue to line up on one side or the other. The issue itself gets lost. And all of a sudden, the pro-gun and the anti-gun people are going to line up on this one, just as they have on church shootings and other things like this, suggesting, oh, if only the minister or if only the congregants all carried guns. You know, I just don't think that guns should be in places like this. Dana, in the United States, we've got about 308 million Americans, 280 million guns that we know or suspect. That's at least one gun for every person, but there are places that guns simply don't belong. And I understand if a bad guy has a gun in a place and nobody else does, he's going to rule the day. Well, that's why we have 911 on our phone, and that's what we should be doing. You know, the last thing I want is to be involved in a shootout in an airplane at 40,000 feet or in a bar that's got about 250 people at the same time, and all of a sudden everybody pulls out a gun and starts cranking off rounds. It was like when, Dana, when I was at Virginia Tech when Cho did that terrible mass murder there. I was there for the entire week, and there were those who came forward and say, yes, every student, every faculty member should be allowed to carry a gun. Dana, I was in those classrooms. I was in those halls. If one or two or three or four people pulled out guns, the ricochets off the wall, off the floor of untrained, frightened, scared people, my God, we would have had more dead than we saw there. So, you know, it sounds like I'm lining up on one side of an issue, too, but I think the less guns we have in an area, leave the guns to law enforcement, let them deal with the bad guys.
That's well said. Clint Van Zandt is here. And something that we can't ignore or can't look away from, Clint, are the heroes, the nurses in this facility. One male nurse shot 27 times.
27 times. Yeah. You know, again, that's probably, you know, as you and, you know, most of your listeners know, when somebody's shooting 12-gauge double-aught buck, that's nine pellets about the size of a .33 caliber bullet in every round coming out. So those 27 are probably accounted by, you know, either single-aught, double-aught, triple-aught buck. But I tell you what, a bullet is a bullet, and a pellet is a pellet. When those things are punching through your body, and, you know, Dana, that guy, that male nurse who died was a former Coast Guardsman. He was someone who had already given his all for his country, and he came out of the Coast Guard, and he went in this. You know, he went in to help people again, and while other employees were allegedly jumping out the windows running, he put himself between the shooter and his patients, men and women between the ages of 78 and 98, and he took 27 rounds trying to stop this shooter. That's another hero for you.
My God, you know, that gives you goosebumps. So let's look at the psychological aspect of this. One would say, you know, the guy's nuts. Well, that's a simple answer for someone who comes into a nursing home like this. But when we see these types of mass killings, and that's my term, what are we looking at as far as psychological issues, Clint?
Well, first of all, this was a directed crime. You know, when it first came out, it was saying there's no connection to the nursing home. And I said, nah, there's going to be a connection. He's got a current or former significant other, somebody in that nursing home. Well, as it turns out, his former first wife worked in that nursing home. She's the person he reached out to, even though he's not had contact for 8 years. The shooter tried to reach out to her within the last week, suggesting that he had cancer and that he was going to go on some type of a long trip. Well, then he goes, like so many incidents of violence in a workplace, where, you know, let's say hypothetically the victim is a former wife or former girlfriend, and she has been stalked, she has been harassed by her boyfriend, ex-husband, whatever the case may be. Well, Dana, you and I know she can change her address. She can change the color of her hair. She can swap license plates once a week. But the one constant thing is the workplace. That's where most people know they can find you if they want to find you. They know where you're going to be 8 hours a day. And I think this guy went looking for his ex-wife. She barricaded herself inside of one of the offices and wouldn't let him in. And I think this guy, in his anger, his rage, his frustration, started just cranking off rounds at senior citizens. Not that he was there, that he had any vendetta against any of these 70 to 90 plus year old people, but Dana, I think he was trying to punish his ex-wife by hurting what was dear to her, in essence, her patience. I did a radio show earlier today where in Illinois, a man had kidnapped his two children from his former wife and murdered them and committed suicide. Why? Because he wanted to punish her. He wanted to make her feel pain the rest of her life. I think that's a similar situation in this North Carolina shooting. And not to give any of these shooters a platform to stand on, to pound their chest and say, I'm a victim. But I think each of these guys I just talked about in their own way were probably victims of severe depression. And there are obvious evidence, there are signs, outward manifestations of depression that people simply choose to ignore, disregard, not deal with. You know, we do need to be our brother's keeper. And when we see someone who's, you know, showing these signs, when they've got financial losses, they're talking about being depressed, they have suicidal ideation, they talk about dying, they're hopeless, they're helpless, they tell people goodbye, they want to get their life in order, you know, they don't dress or act the same, they've gained weight, they've lost weight, they're abusing alcohol, and on, when we see these things, they should jump out at us and say, that's a guy who's in trouble. But the issue, Dana, is a guy. Yeah. Most of men are depressed, and men commit suicide probably at a rate of about 4 to 1 compared to women. And even though about 80% of depression can be taken care of through counseling and medication, men run from admitting that we have problems like that and therefore wind up being victims of themselves.
Yeah, and we all become victims of them, too.
Amen.
Clint Van Zandt is here. You love a mystery, and so do I. We can go back to the Zodiac a long time ago. Now we have the smiley face murders, or do we?
Yeah, you know, the Zodiac is interesting. I was talking to an FBI codebreaker this weekend, and I brought up the Zodiac case because I had been involved in that for years, and, you know, had looked at some of the letters that Zodiac had written. I said, you know, has the Bureau cracked all? He said, we still have one letter. We still have one letter written by Zodiac that we haven't cracked. I said, well, who's going to do it? The FBI, the CIA? He says, who's going to do it is probably some guys on the Internet.
Yep.
Who find that letter, who work and who take an entirely different approach. He said, that's who's probably going to break it. But, you know, here we are dozens of years later, and that case still haunts us. And now we have a new one, the smiley face killer, where we have two former detectives from the NYPD who are suggesting that a gang, a cult, a syndicate, a group of serial killers for the past dozen years or more have crisscrossed America, winding up in at least 25 traveling to college campuses in about 25 different cities in a dozen different states, targeting 19 to 23-year-old attractive, intelligent, mainly white men, they say. They identify these guys. They're supposed to be jocks. They're supposed to have a high grade point average. They supposedly slip them GHB, you know, the date rape drug that men normally, unfortunately, slip women. And then they get these guys, and either through the drug or through alcohol, they murder them. They dispose of their body in the water. They leave some type of happy face or smiley face caricature near the water where they went in, again, in 25 different cities. And in a dozen years, these two detectives suggest that local, state, and federal law enforcement has ignored their evidence and has ignored that there is a gang who has killed somewhere between 40 and 100 victims across this country, and that no one has ever linked them together.
when you look at these types of serial killings, assuming this is what this is, and you look at the smiley face, or you look at the zodiac, or you look at the messages that are left behind, or the symbols, a lot of people sit back and say, why a smiley face? Why something from the zodiac? Why this? Why that? And it makes you wonder. And you look at the evidentiary aspect of it, Clint, it is so important, is it not, from a profiler's perspective?
Well, it's so important, just as you suggest. And, you know, number one, I guess most importantly, I don't believe this. I don't believe this story that these investigators have come up with. I think that they've hooked up with some very tragic situations. I think that, nobody expects their children to die before they do. And when you're paying for your kid to go to school, and he's 19 to 23, and he's a good-looking guy, and he's making good grades, and all of a sudden he's dead, you want to believe that he didn't just wind up drunk and falling in the water, or that he committed suicide. You want to believe there's this terrible gang of killers, and that your child was a totally innocent victim. And while some of these, 40 to 100 supposed homicides that these two ex-detectives are trying to link together, you know, there may be one or two or three homicides in there that cops have missed, but so far, the police of all the agencies across the country who have looked at this, the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit, VICAP, everybody who's looked at it says, by and large, tragic losses, alcohol-related, but no evidence of a serial killer or a syndicate of killers across the country. But Dana, these are the things that, you know, made for TV movies are made out of. Yeah. And parents want answers. And I don't blame them for wanting an answer, but that doesn't mean that we have to make up boogeymen to fulfill that answer.
And that's exactly where I was going with my next question. Clint Van Zandt is here, and we're talking about a bunch of different things, in particular the smiley face killers. When you look at the media and how they cover this, and they feed into the serial killer aspect of it, because it's going to garner more interest, it's going to sell more papers or get more listeners or more viewers, how does that, and I'm going to use the term, obstruct the investigation or make it worse or better?
Yeah, I think it does obstruct. I think that there are people, there are talk show hosts at night that fan the fires of serial killers, and it doesn't need to be done. My position has always been, give the investigators, the detectives, the FBI agents, whoever it is, give them the room they need to work the case. But the media is there, and they hype up the public. They get them, chasing down gerbil runs that, lead to nowhere. And now you've got hundreds, thousands of people believing that there's this gang of serial killers. I've gotten calls, I write my weekly article for Newsvine.com. and MSNBC.com, and I wrote one March 22nd entitled The Smiley Face Killers. I've had calls to our office from people who have children in college. They're considering sending their child to a different college, so they want to find out which ones the smiley face killers are not operating at.
Jeez.
You got to grab people by the shoulders and say, folks, don't believe everything you hear on television. Mm-hmm. Don't believe everything you read in the newspaper. Find multiple sources before, you let some female talk show host on television just hype and rant and rage and suggest things that just aren't true.
Yeah, verify. And if you're interested in that article, there's a link to it in our show notes. Clint, whether it's smiley face killers, whether it's North Carolina or Oakland or wherever, we still have the Holloway cases and the Anthony cases and all these other cases that are still before us. And eventually, you're a media guy, you got to run out of things to say about it, but yet we keep hearing about it week to week. A lot of it is just plain and simple nonsense, but the people seem to want to keep hearing it, or am I wrong?
No, I think you're right, and the thing is, there is a significant portion of the population, unfortunately, that lives vicariously through these crimes. And they will sit there, and numbers are what sells. And I mean, there are talk show hosts at night that are averaging, 1.5-2 million viewers that are sitting there watching the same story be told night after night. Nothing changes. Nothing significantly changed in the Natalie Holloway story for months and months. And yet we ran that every night. Well, now we're seeing two other stories concerning little girls down in Florida. And the same thing again. You know, one is dead, one is missing. And every night these shows run these stories. They don't change anything. It's all the salacious. It's all this breaking news, you know. And you say, well, maybe I ought to listen to it, breaking news. It's something you heard 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. But all they're trying to do is sell themselves, sell their stories. And when I see these talk show hosts, and they enjoy putting down police officers, putting down lawyers, putting down other people in the media, that's what that thing in your hand is for, so you can click that show off. There are shows that we just shouldn't watch because they feed the dark side of us, and they feed a part of us that, you know, we should be concerned with the economy, we should be concerned with health issues. Let law enforcement deal with these others.
Yeah, that's so true. But when you see these types of stories, and we mention the families, all of a sudden you almost send out false hope. In fact, in some cases you do send out false hope because the families are really looking for answers. And if some dopey talk show host at night that has the million viewers starts spewing off some stuff that they haven't verified, or they're just like they're calling bombshell new news, which is really old, it's that false hope, I think, that is so disappointing, at least from my perspective, to see these families think about it and then all of a sudden get slammed down again.
Yeah, we know there can't be anything worse than, you know, either you either have a child that's missing or a child that's been assaulted and murdered. But, you know, if we take the case of missing children, I mean, in the United States, there are upwards of 1 million people that are initially reported missing every year. Now, most of them are found. Some of them are runaway, walk away, whatever it's going to be. But many of them are young children. And some come back, some are never seen again. You know, those are the ones that break our hearts, that we investigate, that we hang in there and do it. Those are the ones where people, I've met families, Dana, you know the families that our hearts are breaking. You know, they never want to sell their house. The porch light is always on. They don't ever change their home phone number or their cell phone number because they're afraid their child will call one night, even though the child's been missing 5 years, 10 years. You know, I've got friends of mine, in their case, their daughter committed suicide when she was 21. And she was one of four children, but you walk in their house, and on the wall, you see the picture of that 21-year-old girl who now would be in her 30s. But she is forever frozen at 21 years old, yeah, in their mind and on the wall. Well, that's the same way with people whose children have been kidnapped. And when some of these shows hold out or roll out false hope, it's like I was on Dr. Phil one time with Natalie Holloway's mother, Beth Holloway Twitty, and I. And we were talking before we went on the show, and I said, Beth, Dr. Phil's going to roll out some suggestion that maybe your daughter was kidnapped and she's being held as a sex slave on some island off the coast of Aruba, someplace like that. I said, no, that, you know, the government, the CIA, the FBI, and other agencies, we've been down there, we've checked that out. There is no truth to that whatsoever. And she said, well, Clint, you know, you got to have hope.
Yeah.
And I said, Beth, you got to have hope, but not false hope. And I think that's the issue here, that so many of these shows, programs, writers, they extend false hope that just cannot be supported statistically. Everybody wants to believe that their case is going to be resolved like Elizabeth Smart, the teenager who was kidnapped in Salt Lake and was missing for almost a year, and then she was recovered alive and safe and returned to her parents. God, don't we wish every case would be resolved like that. But the reality is, when it concerns a child, most children, if we don't get them back within the first 12 to 24 hours, we're probably not going to get them back alive. And that's a terrible statistic, that when a parent says, tell me the truth, I always used to hedge my bet, and they'd look you in the eye and they'd say, I need to know what the probability is. And you'd say, I tell you what, we're going to work this case night and day, and I'm going to work this, and my emotional porch light is going to stay on until we resolve this.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality, the statistical reality is, in cases like this, we don't get a whole lot of kids back.
Yeah, and that's so unfortunate, and we'll keep working hard to try and get them back. Clint Van Zandt, it's always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Dana, thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's retired FBI agent Clint Van Zandt. And, you know, always have hope. The Kesseys and the Holloways and everyone should always have hope. But what I don't like is the false hope that gets spewed in the media sometimes, and it just brings people down, and really does no good for anyone except the ratings of the show that is going to air it. We're going to take a break, and we're going to be back with police officer, author, co-host of the Justice Interrupted show on Tuesday night, Stacey Dietrich, and we're going to get more into the Oakland police murders. My name is Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. Yeah, I got to hit the button right, or we could have had that funky music playing in the background. If you go to the Women in Crime blog, womenincrimeinc.blogspot.com, you'll see my next guest's story about the Oakland police murders. Clint Van Zandt and I were just talking about that, but we're going to talk more about that with Stacey Dietrich. You know, Stacey as an author, a police officer, co-host of the Justice Interrupted radio program on Tuesdays, and she's also on the Nancy Grace Show and any other show that you can pick her up on as a legal and police analyst. Stacey, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. How is everybody tonight?
Oh, we're doing good. You know,
good.
I said to Clint, and Clint's an old fart like I am, old-timer, and we think a lot alike. I said, you know, I'm getting so sick and tired of the media only talking about the negatives of policing. We hear about that dipstick Drew Peterson, and they still talk about him as Sergeant Peterson. He hasn't been a policeman for a long time now.
Right.
We hear about the idiot cop that beat up his wife. Okay, that's wrong. That shouldn't happen. But when's the last time you heard something good about a cop that maybe pulled somebody out of a burning car? Or here we have this shooting at the nursing home in North Carolina. This young cop, probably making 20-some grand a year, goes in, takes four rounds in the leg while he shoots it out with this maniac. And then in Oakland, we get four officers lose their lives. God, I watched a clip of the funeral the other day, and it made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. I was, you know, I'm getting too old for this. I'm getting emotional watching it. Yet there's a damn support protest going on for the shooter. Is the whole world going to hell?
You know, and I talked about this last night. Unfortunately, you know, if I lived in Oakland, I would be furious.
Yeah.
I watched a vigil, and, you know, thousands and thousands of people in the community came out for this, black and white. And the media is focusing on that small pocket.
Yep.
That's doing the protest, and that's just wrong. There's no rhyme or reason to that. And I think, you know, if you ignore them, hopefully they'll go away. Maybe they won't. But if they're talking to a wall and they're not getting the attention, you know, they'll go elsewhere. But they're getting the attention. And for the families of the slain officers, it's sickening. It's such a slap in the face. And one of the issues that I had was that each single time I have seen, you know, the minute bit that has been portrayed in the media on the Oakland shootings, it has been immediately followed by a quote-unquote dirty cop story.
Yep.
That lasts about 15 minutes.
Yep.
And that has been on every station, and it's almost comical. It's almost comical anymore that it's become this transparent.
You know, and I've blamed police departments, and I still do somewhat in the past, because they don't do enough to promote their officers. But damn it, the media. And I think O'Reilly had it right the other night. He had one of the organizers of this Oakland protest or support for the shooter on, and when he confronted the guy saying that there was only 50 or 60 people at this so-called protest, yet the cameras were making it look like it was a huge protest, it just showed the mentality, I guess, and that's my word, of the media.
Exactly.
They look at that and they glom onto that story, and damn it, Stacey, I'm just getting so sick of this. You're so right. You see all these dirty cop stories, but nothing, very seldom nothing, unless some poor officer has lost their lives.
But not even that, Dana.
Yeah.
How many officers get killed yearly?
And we don't hear about it.
I mean, is everyone, and some years there may only be 100. I mean, where are these, you know, via horrific vehicle accidents while trying to save the life of somebody, to drownings, chasing a suspect into rivers, to shootings and stabbings, and these men and women are dying horribly, and you just... you know, saving people. And, you know, again, what I touched on last night is there's this 12-year-old little girl who the day before the shootings, they actually matched his DNA. I know it read like the rape actually occurred the day before the shootings, but they actually matched the his DNA to that rape the day before the shootings. Where are these people supporting this innocent child?
Yeah.
You know, where are the people supporting these officers' families and this innocent 12-year-old that was brutally raped by this piece of garbage? You know, it's, and when they refer to the whole incident, they say 5 slain.
Yeah.
They're including, and see, little things like that just, oof, rub me the wrong way.
Well, you know, and it's just... Yeah, rubbing you the wrong way. It just, well, it's, hell, I'll say it. It just pisses me right off. Stacy Dittrich is here. You'll hear Stacy Tuesday nights on Justice Interrupted radio program. You know, not harping on the media all night, but I think it's a big part of the story. Sure, there are dirty cops out there, Stacy. You know it. I know it. We hear the stories about them. But we also have to look at, and I always get in trouble when I go along this line, but I was a union guy, too, for a number of years. That,
oh, isn't that awful? I was, too.
Not
worst job in the world. People don't realize.
Oh, God, are you right, for sure. not only as a police officer, you accountable to the courts the same as anyone else, but you're also accountable internally. There's internal discipline. You're almost, as an officer, guilty until proven as innocent in some cases. And I get in trouble for saying that, but darn it, it is true. But there's a higher standard for police officers. But isn't it time that higher standard be reflected in how that officer is trained, how that officer is paid, how that officer is respected in the community and by the media? If we're going to be held accountable like that, then we should be given the credit for it, or am I going out to lunch here?
No, and I'll tell you something, which you said earlier, I think it does go back to the higher police officials that are throwing these guys under the bus.
Yep.
And, you know, if these, with all the negativity out there, it's almost, you know, these officers are getting put at a higher risk than they already are. And I used the example last night that, you know, if I were to come upon a suspect and he wanted to just clean my clock,
yep,
you know, 10 years ago, he might have thought twice about it. But now he's like, you know, all I got to say is she did something wrong. The media's going to, I'll call the newspaper. They're going to make her look bad. The sheriff's going to throw her under the bus, and I'll be good to go. So I might as well just take my chances. And that's true.
Yep.
Unfortunately.
Well, and you see the 30-second soundbite or video clip on TV, and, you know, here's this aggressive officer. What happened before that? What happened after that? What was this all about? You know, you are trained as an officer to protect life and property, use as much force as necessary when making an arrest. But it's this whole stigma, and maybe it started with Rodney King. I don't know. Probably before that.
Again, a small clip of what actually happened.
Yeah, exactly. And by no means am I defending those that were excessive with Rodney King. I will be the first one to say that, because I've gotten trouble on this program for saying that before, but years ago. But when you know, Stacy, you were also not only a police officer, but you're a minority police officer as far as a woman police officer goes, and that's no disrespect, because times are changing, thank God, where females are getting into policing, being respected more in policing and the military, and being used for their talents in policing much better than they were before. But it's that whole, you know, here I'm going to reverse this a little bit. When's the last time that you've seen a negative story about a dirty female cop?
that's funny. And I'll tell you something. I get, you know, as you know, I'm sure get accused of being the almighty of those in blue. You know, always protecting those in blue.
Yep.
And I am the first one, and I know, you know, I've worked with dirty cops, and I loathe dirty cops.
Yep.
They make all of us look bad and our jobs harder. And one, and my first true crime book coming out this fall is actually... it focuses on stories of police officers that have completely gone over the edge and been convicted of murder, like Bobby Cutts.
Yep.
Stephen Rios. There's 20 stories in there. I included two females in there that may or may not have gotten a lot of attention. Of course, you've got the Bambi Benbenek story in there, but you've also got Antoinette Frank, who was just a nightmare. I mean, this was like this mass killer of New Orleans, and she was a female police officer. But, you know, I had never actually heard of that case until I started researching that book.
That's my point.
And she is one of two females on Louisiana's death row. Her sentence has been stayed I don't know how many times. She actually murdered her own partner. And, you know, there's just no defense there. They find her father's body buried underneath her home a year after she's been convicted with a bullet hole in his head. And, you know, again, her execution was set for this December and again was delayed. And it's like, come on. You know, how can you justify that? And, you know, with the women, I didn't see anything of it. I happened to be following that case, but it applies to the same thing here. A criminal is a criminal is a criminal.
Yep.
Don't pick and choose.
That's the way that's the way it should be.
Exactly.
That's the way it should be. Stacey Dittrich is here, and we're talking about the Oakland police murders and other things. Getting back to that and your story in the Women in Crime blog, and again, that's Women in Crime Inc. INK.blogspot.com. When you see this so-called protest, when you see the response of those involved saying, "Yeah, these officers lost their lives, but many of our people lost their lives at the hands of police," how do you respond to that?
Yeah, there's a way. This is what people don't take into consideration, and I'm going to use my own husband as an example. He would be extremely upset if he knew this, but you're talking about a city with a very high black population.
Right.
And this is what I explain when I talk about my husband. His district that he works in is above 90% black. It is also the highest crime rate in the city. Not saying that those two go, you know, hand in hand, but that's just the way it is. Those are the statistical facts.
Yep.
So the officers that work in that district have more arrests than the other officers, which in turn, they also have higher uses of force. Now, that's just common sense. As opposed to a guy that works in an allotment in the South Side that hasn't had a crime in 6 months.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? So to compare the two, and is a citizen or is a police administrator to say, you guys are rogue cops, look at your numbers, you've got this many uses of force, or you've got this many arrests. You can't do that. Like I said, you need to look at the statistics of Oakland, looking at their crime rate, looking at their black population. That is going to... that's going to be standard. Not that you've got this white officer on black criminal crime all over the place, but that's just the way it is because these are predominantly black neighborhoods. And if you go to cities all over the country, whether you're in an Asian community or a Hispanic community, and you get into officer-involved shootings, it's always going to be within that ethnicity and that ethnic group.
Yep. And there's all sorts of issues, socioeconomic, you name it. But when it comes down to it, it's the reality of it, folks. And we're certainly not racist here on this program, neither is Stacey. We're just telling you what the facts are. Listen, we're just about out of time. I want you to plug a little bit what's going on the Justice Interrupted radio show.
actually, we've got an, it might, it's probably going to turn out to be interesting. We have a rape victim that's pretty much not using the word victim, but being a survivor, and is going to talk about how she's gone on with her life and what others can do for that. We have a true crime writer. And interestingly enough, our other guests had to reschedule, so I believe I'm going to have my own father on to discuss the ways in the world of policing nowadays. He is a 40-year police veteran, currently a night shift lieutenant. He is a retired lieutenant colonel. And, you know, he can tell you the changes from 1969 to the current state that we are in of our policing and crime.
Wow.
And media exposure.
I'm going to listen to that because I come
from...
He's
a very colorful man, and he'll get on me. He's really upset. He doesn't want to do it, but I said, you're going to have to because we need a guest.
Well, you tell Dad that I'm going to look forward to that because I come from the same background. My father had 38 years in and was also a retired major in the military, and so we were both had the same upbringing, and
yeah.
Now we're doing the same sort of work, and it's honorable work for sure. We just need to hear more about it. Stacy, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Dana. Have a good night.
We'll talk soon.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Stacy Dietrich from Justice Interrupted. She's an author. Go to her website. We have a link in the show notes. And, of course, the Women in Crime, Inc. Blog is an excellent source for all sorts of interesting crime stories. I want to sneak in a quick update from Jessica Taloney, a reporter in Alabama, about the Becca McAvoy case. Of course, we know the Becca McAvoy case of the young girl who lost her life tragically in a traffic accident before she was able to testify against the, here we go again, former police officer. In this case, that's not an issue. I don't care if he was a cop or not. He's alleged to have raped and sodomized this young girl, but she lost her life. It then became an argument about the Supreme Court ruling Crawford versus Washington, and we do have an update, and I went to Jessica Taloney just before showtime to get a quick update on that, so let's go right there. Okay, we're back. I thought I'd bring on Jessica Taloney. She's a news reporter with WKRG News 5. To get an update on the Becca McAvoy case, there is an update. Of course, you'll know Becca as the young girl who lost her life tragically in a traffic accident before she was able to testify against the ex-Chickasaw police officer, Bob Engel, who allegedly raped and sodomized her. Welcome back to the show, Jessica.
Thanks for having me again.
What's going on? We're hearing lots of things. I'm hearing another delay, sadly. The family won't be happy about that. We're hearing about possible gag orders. But what I'd like to start with is that there was actually a ruling came out of the Alabama Supreme Court, was there not, that this trial could proceed?
There was. It was a couple months ago. The Alabama Supreme Court basically denied the defense's request to dismiss this case. The defense wanted it dismissed after Rebecca McAvoy died in a car crash in January 2008, because they're saying it forcing Engel to stand trial would now violate his constitutional right to confront his accuser. Now, the state Supreme Court, the state's highest court, said, no, we're going to let this trial move forward. They were going to allow a young friend of Rebecca's to testify on what Rebecca told her before she died. They were also going to let a doctor testify and a nurse. And as far as I know, that still stands. It's just that the trial date has been postponed to June now.
Yeah, there's been several postponements, and you know, covering these sorts of stories, and I know, my audience knows, that it's so difficult for especially victims and their families to sit back. Is there any scuttlebutt as why another delay, or are either side talking?
I'm sure it's been a roller coaster for them. I actually spoke with the assistant district attorney this afternoon that's prosecuting the case once word started to spread that the case had been postponed again. And I really have lost track on how many times it's postponed. I think we're at 8, but it's somewhere around that many delays we've seen so far. But the family thought there would be jury selection today. They thought Bob Engel would be in court today. We did, too. We had a photographer down there in court to get some video, and it didn't happen. They postponed it to June 15th, and the district attorney would not say why. He only said that both sides, that both the defense and prosecutors, agreed to the delay.
It's hard to say. We can speculate lots on that one. What about a gag order? I'm hearing rumors that there's a gag order, or is this just simply the judge saying, okay, everybody, let's not talk about this. We're going to go to trial.
Right. I've been told by the district attorney's office that there is still not a gag order on this case, although it has been discussed over the last several months. Now, what they did tell me, though, is that the judge gave very strict orders to everyone to not discuss the case. And I'm understanding that the family's been told not to talk about it as well.
Right. One last question. Again, Jessica Taloni is here. She's from WKRG News, Channel 5. At the same time all this was going on, again, a big tragedy down in your area, there was a second case we haven't heard much about, similar sort of circumstances where the child had died before being able to testify. Can you update us on that one?
Sure. All I know about that case, because that, unlike Rebecca McEvoy's family, where they've been very outspoken, they've wanted to make sure there's a lot of attention on their case to make sure that it actually goes to trial. And arguably, perhaps their effort in pushing this case has helped both families getting their case to go to trial. But in this second instance, I understand that the young girl died in a horseback riding accident just while she was waiting for her case to go to trial, just like Rebecca McEvoy. But as far as the circumstances of the case, who the suspect or the defendant is, we don't know anything about it.
Yeah, it's been kept quiet. Jessica, thank you, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Bye-bye. That's news reporter Jessica Taloni, and here we go again with another delay. We can sit back and speculate about why the delay. I have a couple of ideas myself, but I won't even try and discuss them right now to, you know, with the potential that it may upset the family. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
Alrighty, we're back with our weekly edition of Nothing But the Sacks. I got a few emails since last week's edition saying, well, they like that name, but how about Just the Sacks? You know, the Jack Webb thing when he just used to say, just the facts, ma'am. You know, I don't know. Nothing But the Sacks is okay, too. But, you know, Robin Sacks as a ADA out of Los Angeles County, as an author, as one of the co-hosts of the Justice Interrupted radio program. She's a expert on child safety. She's, well, she does just about everything, and she's also welcome on the program. Hi, Robin.
Hello, Dana.
What's new?
Well, you know, that bug, that sinus infection.
Oh, God.
Revisit, you know, it's coming back around here.
This is just brutal. It's like somebody emailed me the plague or something. I've never been so ill in all my days, but nobody's going to feel sorry for us anyway, are they?
No, well, and definitely not Drew Peterson.
I'm going to get to him in a few minutes. Where should I start? I'm going to start with Oakland. Four police officers lost their lives. Then what we see is not so much, although I did watch part of the funeral service for them. God, it just gives me goosebumps to watch that. I'm getting too old, I guess, for that kind of stuff. But to see the protests or of support for the shooter, and I think O'Reilly said it best when he had one of the organizers on there, that there was only 50 or 60 people there, but the damn media just glommed onto that and made it look like it was this huge protest. And, you know, if we're not hearing stories about dirty cops, we don't seem to hear any stories about cops at all unless they lose their lives, or am I wrong?
No, it seems to be the case, actually. And I was actually just talking with someone today about one of the things that communities really could do to help increase the not only the perception but the awareness of what really cops have to go through. I don't really think people think about what it takes to actually keep a city or a county safe, the amount of work that goes into the investigation, the amount of work that goes into what really amounts to getting people punished and penalized and protection of kids and the lives that go out there on a daily basis. And I think that if more people participated in a citizens police academy, and there were actually police academies, you know, that were designed by individual police departments in order to somewhat, and I don't even think it would come close, but somewhat to replicate the process of what it's like in the day of the life of a police officer, particularly one out there, you know, a patrol officer, I think that they could start to see and feel what it is like out there in the trenches.
Yep, absolutely. And that's one of the things, you know, I've been hard on police management over the years, including my own, where they don't do a good job in promoting their officers. But lately, in the last few years, we've seen these citizen police academies, and boy, they're something to get the people out there, but it seems like sometimes there's this apathetic attitude that, you know, who cares, but boy, will they ever jump on the negative stories. But here we have this young officer in North Carolina, a hero, 4 years on the job, probably makes 20 grand a year or not much more than that, goes in and shoots it out with some maniac in a nursing home, takes four slugs himself, is a, you know, a Medal of Valor winner as far as I'm concerned. You know, how many times a day does that happen across the United States and Canada where a police officer does something heroic, pulls somebody from a burning car, does whatever, but people will sit back and say that's their job. But then you have a dirty cop, allegedly, or whatever, or you have a Peterson who hasn't been a cop in a long time who still gets called Sergeant Peterson. When you see all the media, or a good portion of it, about him, he still has his uniform on. Yes, he was in a position of trust when he allegedly did these things, but I'm getting damn sick of it. There are a lot of good cops out there. They're not all Drew Peterson or someone else.
Well, and that's the important thing. There are many, 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 many more good cops out there than there are bad cops. And it's just like anything. It's the, you know, one bad apple seems to spoil the bunch in terms of cops out there. And it is a damn shame because, frankly, you know, one officer who is really egregious, I'm with you. They should be treated as the criminal and the scum that they are if they are a scum. And I don't look at them as a cop anymore. I look at them as a crook,
yep,
which is what they are, and if they've abused their position of trust, then more of a sentence should be, you know, delivered to them as well. But there should be recognition, and the statistics and the information is so skewed in the media, and that's why, unfortunately, we're at record lows for people, good people, who want to enter into law enforcement, combined with the atrocity of a salary scale that cops and law enforcement and prosecutors myself have to deal with. I mean, that's just a whole other subject.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, hey, there are dirty cops out there, and let's skewer, is that the word you use, those suckers, because they deserve it. But remember, there's a lot of good ones out there. Changing tune a little bit, Robin Sachs is here with her weekly Nothing But the Sachs segment. Becca McAvoy, we all know that case, the young girl who tragically lost her life before she was able to testify against the, here we go again, ex-police officer who allegedly raped and sodomized her. We have a ruling out of the Alabama Supreme Court. We just had a news reporter on talking about that, saying the trial will go ahead. It's delayed again, sadly. We can speculate why this trial has been delayed again, agreed to by the DAM, the defense, by the way. But your thoughts on Becca McAvoy?
Well, there's so many issues with that case. That case is just a shame from the beginning. I stand by it, and just in terms of the Crawford and hearsay,
yeah,
decisions that we talked about earlier in the year, or last year actually, now at this point, about how the statements that were made to the Becca statements that were made to the medical examiners may not have been able to be admissible under the Crawford decision. And I really have an issue with the prosecutor in this case delaying and agreeing to a continuance in this case, frankly. The people of the state of Alabama, the people in the state of this country, have a right to a speedy trial. And in my mind, there is no benefit from a prosecutor, especially at this point, to delay a case. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, minor continuances that happen at the beginning of a case just to get everyone to get the evidence, you know, get the DNA back, get those kinds of things back together and get all the ducks in a row. But really, the only thing that gets better with age is fine wine, as far as I'm concerned.
What's it smell like to you? You know, and I'm not using that as a derogatory comment, but to see a continuance. Now, the news reporter thought this was the eighth one. Should I say it? Shouldn't I say it? Yeah, let's say it. Is there a plea deal on the table?
Well, I don't know that I think that there's a plea deal on the table, and I kind of have to take issue with you, Dana, in the way that you kind of have that negative connotation of plea deals, because I, you know, that's something that I'm kind of on a mission this year. I've decided to, you know, kind of, well, first of all, I'm on a personal mission to make sure the plea deals that are done are appropriate and fair.
Right.
Our system really does depend on plea bargaining, and there's a lot of great plea bargains. I mean, you know, right about 2 or 3 weeks ago, someone pled as a plea bargain to 36 years in state prison.
Right.
And that's a hell of a good plea, as far as I'm concerned. So there's lots of good reasons for plea bargaining, so I don't want to give it a negative connotation. But in this case, I doubt that there's a plea bargain. Why? He's got, you know, he's been bolstered by time delay. He's been certainly helped by delay in terms of, you know, the untimely death of poor Becca. So, gosh, he may just hit the lottery if he goes to trial on this thing, I think, in his mind. What I think, though, what I don't like about it is that I think that the prosecution's theory at this moment is a hope that the attention and interest in this case will make the case somehow lose its power, and that way they don't have to go by with the scrutiny that may otherwise happen with people like you and myself who are watching this case to see, make sure that law enforcement and the prosecutor and everyone who has a position of being able to do something actually does what they're supposed to do.
Well, you know, and I agree with you, and I accept the spanking you gave me as far as the plea deals go, but that wasn't my point. My point is that after 8 continuances or 7, why this one right now, where both agree, obviously if there's a continuance, usually both agree or the judge decides, but if a plea deal works and you know 36 years, you're absolutely right, that's a good plea deal. But all of a sudden now, how long can the defense sit back and stall, and it must just be tearing this family, who I know, apart, because they just think it'll never end.
Well, and it does, and it is awful to put the family through that. I mean, every single time, not to mention every day that you're in court feels like hours, and just to go there to find out the case is continued, it is a big, it's heartbreaking, it's awful. It usually a judge would like to, especially when there has been 7 or 8 continuances, would like to hear that there's a reasonable chance that this case may settle in order to agree for a time waiver or continuance. But I don't know if there wasn't some additional discovery reason, conflict, or some other thing that both the prosecutor and the defense kind of winked at each other. I mean, honestly, it happens. You know, I've seen it, and, you know, lawyers accommodate each other. Who knows? Maybe the prosecutor's kid's spring break is next week, like my kid, or maybe that they have, you know, a big conference that they want to go to at the end of the month, and that they're going to try to extend some professional courtesy, which has nothing to do with a plea bargain in the case.
Yep. No, you're right. Robin Sachs is here with her nothing but the sex comment. Whatever the hell it is. We're talking anyway. We're having fun. I have a question from a listener. I'd be interested to hear if Robin Sachs has any insight into whether California lawyer Todd Mancuso, I can't say that, will be able to be admitted onto the Casey Anthony defense team. Before you answer that, if I see Nancy Grace run the picture of Casey Anthony peeing between the two cars again one more time, I am going to puke all over the TV. It's going to be such an ugly sight. What the hell is she keeps showing this picture for? You know, this story, as tragic as it is, we're out of things to talk about. I think this story needs to be set aside a little bit. Yeah, report on the trial, obviously. But this, it's just become such a media circus now. And seeing these dumb pictures of her in her little nightie and her taking a pee out in the thing and all this sort of stuff. Important, yes, at the start, I believe so. But now, over and over and over again, it's getting sickening.
Well, I have to say, it just kind of cracked me up that those pictures go out there. I mean, it does show, you know, who she is. I'm with you, though. Frankly, I mean, and I, you know, of course, I am regular on Nancy Grace, and I really like a lot of what she has to say. But one of the things that I'm troubled with is there are so many other cases. I mean, really, and you know, every day cases like this that happen in every county across this country and across your wonderful country as well. And really, we should be highlighting some of the cases that so badly need media attention. And the McAvoy's is a perfect example of one of those cases.
Yep.
I have to tell you, Todd Mancuso, I believe is his name.
Yeah.
You know, it's at this point, I don't know much about him personally, actually. I've never met him. And at this point, it seems to me that they can add as many people onto their case as they, you know, want to add onto their case, unless there is some sort of financial or other reason not to. I know that there's some issues in terms of his, you know, being under investigation and so forth, and that may change whether or not he's actually going to be involved. But other than in terms of, is there anything preventing him from being involved? No.
No, you know, and then again, this case will go to trial unless there's a continuance, but it will go to trial eventually. But Nancy Grace, God love you, dear. Pick another story to talk about. There's Haley Cummings. There's other stories. There's more information now coming out on Holloway and all the missing people out there and all the tragic stories about what's going on. You don't need to keep showing Casey Anthony taking a pee on the parking lot. Robin's new book, Predators and Child Molesters, What Every Parent Needs to Know to Keep Kids Safe, a sex crime DA answers 100 of the most asked questions. I'm amazed with my cough tonight. I was able to get through that without coughing my head off. And, of course, the foreword is by Mark Klass, and Robin Sachs is a regular on the program each week here on Scared Monkeys Radio. And, of course, Robin can be heard Tuesday nights on the Justice Interrupted radio show. Give that a plug. What are you guys doing on there next week?
You know, tomorrow night's show, it should be a very interesting show. We have actually two guests that I'm very familiar with, one of which is a author and who is a regular contributor to People magazine, and her first name is Vicky, and I can't pronounce her last name, so I'll do that tomorrow. And she actually was part of an under the radar investigation into doctors who've committed sex crimes, and the amount of work that it took in terms of exposing this one doctor who probably raped about 40 of his own women patients.
Wow.
And then we have another person whose name is Catherine Cavanaugh. She's coming on, and she is going to really talk about the difference of life from victim to survivor. Really a classic example of someone who has taken her victimhood and experiences as a victim of sexual assault and turned it into being a survivor. Not an advocate, not anyone who's involved in out there, you know, saying the word out aloud, but really just about living her life and choices she made in terms of empowering herself so that we can see that there's kind of an other life. And then there's a third guest, and I believe her name is Jody, and I don't know much about her until I read my script for tomorrow.
There you go, and that's Justice Interrupted on Blog Talk Radio. That's Stacey Dietrich, Robin Sachs, my guest this evening, and Susan Murphy Milano. Make sure and tune in. Thank you, Robin. We'll see you again next week.
Thank you. See you next week.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right, that's tonight's show. Of course, you remember our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live, pick up podcasts of past shows. You can listen to my daily commentary, leave comments. You can do pretty much anything you want to there. Thanks a lot for listening. We'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
Been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.